Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the roundtable and webinar on evolving structures for real estate investment funds. This roundtable is being organized by Nishit Desai Associates in association with IVCA, the Indian Private Equity and Venture Capital Association, and APREA, the Asian Pacific Real Estate Association. The speakers are Shobhit Agarwal, Managing Partner, Capital Markets, Jones Lang LaSalle, Nitin Gupta, Managing Director, Macquarie Capital Advisors India, Karan Bolaria, Head, Real Estate Funds, Godrej Properties Limited, Nishchal Joshipura, Partner, Private Equity and Private Debt, Nishit Desai Associates, and Ruchi Sinha, Co-Head, Private Equity and Private Debt Investments, Nishit Desai Associates. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of today's discussion. Should you need assistance during this conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star and then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. Also, you can download our mobile applet, Nishit Mobile, which is available on the App Store of iOS device. Play Store for Androids and BlackBerry World to access the current updates and videos. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Ruchi Sinha. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
I think Shobhit, that you can take it up.
Thank you. I guess you guys are running a little late. I'll get straight to the subject. First of all, thank you all for coming in this morning and taking up time. Nishit Desai for organizing it and all my fellow panelists for being here.
The subject as evolving structures for real estate investment.
I'll quickly give you a background on why it is so apt and relevant. We've been doing some studies and we've figured that private equity real estate fundraising has been on the rise, and this is a global trend. This year, in the first 6 months globally, $43 billion have been raised. This is up from $33 billion, which was done during the first 6 months of last year, same period last year. What is very interesting is that as more money is being raised, it's concentrated now in hands of more people. Last year, 106 people received $33 billion. This year, 77 managers received $43 billion. Right? Then, of course, not only is it concentrated, I think it's also in different terms, different styles. Co-mingled funds are getting a little bit out of fashion. Managed accounts, separate accounts, aggregated accounts, call it what you like, JV structures. These are becoming more in vogue or fashionable.
We are here to debate that.
And also the fact that, recently the government has relaxed the FDI norms by their press release on 29th October. We really want to discuss how India positions vis-a-vis what's happening around the globe, and it's really, towards modification impacting real estate. Has it started to impact, and what are the trends? Within India, in the larger context, within India itself, because there's more money that's being raised around globally, there has been some positive impact. We've seen that in the first 6 months, and the data is available from Jan to June, we've deployed $1.2 billion in private equity style investing, as opposed to $1.2 billion that got invested whole of last year. So really, we don't know where it's going to end. My guess is more closer to $2 billion. But yes, the money is pouring in and starting to create a positive impact. Let me just start the conversation with Ruchi and Nishchal on what are the major relaxations of FDI apart from the most interesting one on completed assets, which need a little bit longer debate, and we'll come back to it later. Really, Nishchal, what are we going to, what do you think as the, you know, what are the major changes? Which you think? You would like to take that first?
Yeah. So as we all know, first time foreign investment in real estate was relaxed was in March 2005. And through a press note which was called, famously called Press Note 2 of 2005. Now, who was the biggest beneficiary of that press note? The conference organizers. In the next 6 months, we saw at least 200 conferences being successfully organized just to understand what was the intent of that two-page press note because it was so ambiguous. Following that, there were multiple interpretations taken by the regulators on each and every provision of Press Note 2, followed by multiple amendments which the regulators made as far as the lock-in and tranche by tranche payout of foreign investment was concerned. The latest of all has been the amendment of October 29, which again will be incorporated as part of the law through a press note. Now, there are three or four significant changes which have been made under this press release. The first one being the minimum area, as far as the project is concerned, has been reduced from 50,000 square meter to 20,000 square meter. Now, this is something which will help the metros and especially cities like Mumbai, where to find 50,000 square meter project is very difficult. So, at least the projects which are between 20 to 50,000 square meter will be eligible for receiving FDI as per the new rules. Second is there has been a change in the parameter based on which the area is calculated. Earlier it was built up area. Now they have changed it to floor area. And they have said that floor area will be as per the definitions under the local laws. Now we checked few laws, especially floor area is a definition which is used a lot in some of the laws in Gujarat, especially Ahmedabad, Baroda and some of the local laws. So it remains to be seen whether all the states and all the cities do they have the definition of floor area under the respective laws. But otherwise, the intent is very clear that Gujarat is going to be the biggest exporter of laws for India in the near future. Since some of these terms have been picked up from the local laws in Gujarat. The next big change is on the minimum capitalization norms, which earlier was 5 million for joint ventures and 10 million for only on subsidiaries. That has been changed to 5 million for everybody. So that's another change. The two major changes which have been made which could impact the funding and exit of for private equity investors is the first one is the government has allowed subsequent tranches of investment to be made till the completion of project or for a period of 10 years from the commencement of the project. Now, this is a big change because earlier the one of the view which was always taken is that FDI is allowed only in early stage construction development projects. And there was no definition of what is early stage construction. Would it be 25%, 30%, 50%, 60%, or can you also fund a project till it is 90-95% complete? There was always this debate. One of the extreme views was that till the time you get the occupation certificate for the project, you can still get funding from a foreign investor. This has been formally introduced under the new law. What it says is that till the time the project is completed, you can still receive funding. And one of the reasons was a lot of representations were made to the regulators on last mile funding. Because a lot of projects were stuck because they were not getting last mile funding from the foreign investors because of this ambiguity on early stage construction development projects. So that's a positive change as far as the real estate sector is concerned. Second important change is on the lock-in. Earlier, the lock-in was 3 years from the date of each installment of foreign investment. They have now changed it to 3 years from the date of final installment or completion of the project, whichever is earlier, subject to development of trunk infrastructure. Now, trunk infrastructure, they are not specifically defined, but they have said it basically will include your drainage, sewerage, and you know roads, all the ancillary facilities, as long as you build, it should be fine. Now, the intent of this change, again, is to align the interest of the foreign investor with the developer. The intent of the government is to ensure that the project gets developed. And that's why if you see the changes, for last mile funding, they have said that, you know, you can put in foreign money for the completion of the project. Here also, they have linked the exit of the foreign investor with the completion of the project. Now, on one hand, this is a positive change because there were a lot of resi projects which got sold within 2-2.5 years. But because of the 3-year lock-in requirement, the foreign investors are not able to exit. Now, with this relaxation that you can exit upon completion of the project, even if you are not going to get stuck if your entire project is sold and you are not completed 3 years. On the flip side, there have been a lot of exits which have happened where majority of the portion of foreign investment had completed 3 years, but there was a small portion, which was the final tranche, which has not completed 3 years. So there were two-stage exits which were structured, where 80-90% of the foreign investment was taken over, was repatriated, but at the same time, 10% was stuck, which the foreign investors are comfortable with. But with this new change, where even if the project has not been completed, and you have, let's say, your lock-in for majority of 90% of your investment has expired, but now since the lock-in is linked to the last tranche of the investment, and you cannot exit for a period of 3 years from the last tranche of investment, this is going to create some issues as far as the exit for the foreign investors is concerned. So broadly, these are the major changes, and maybe Richard, you may want to add a couple of others.
No, I think you mentioned the issue of trunk interest. So I think one of the biggest comforting factor which I see from it also is the 50% and 5 years rules. That seems to have been taken off. Because there was a very ambiguous provision, section 2, which said that 50% of your project must be completed within 5 years of obtaining all statutory approvals. No one understood what is 50% completion. No one understood what does all statutory approval mean, right? And, you know, in many cases, people said that, oh, you know, where we have not received any approvals itself, and I've completed 3 years of holding the land, I could sell it because my 5 to 50% rule has not triggered and my 3-year lock-in is finished. So, you know, it was just giving too much ambiguity. And the large foreign institutional clients, I think it gives them a lot of discomfort to realize that the condition like this exists, but they don't understand what it is, right? So I think that has been taken off and has been replaced with the concept of trunk infrastructure. Now, with trunk infrastructure, you just develop the basic infrastructure and you're able to sell it off. I think on a different point, you know, there was a concept of undeveloped plots under Section 2005 for service housing plots, right? Now, in those kind of service housing plots, it said that, you know, a plot or a service housing, you know, that then a project would be, you know, or an undeveloped plot would be one where you have not received the completion certificate, right? So essentially, if you had to qualify something as a service housing plot which was saleable, you had to get a completion certificate. Now, the practicality of the matter was that in many of the jurisdictions or many of the local areas, the local authorities did not understand what is a completion certificate for a service housing plot, for instance, Bangalore. We went and they said, you know, we don't understand this. The challenge is you have a service housing plot, you built up the infrastructure, but now you have no way of establishing that you've done it because that completion certificate would never come through for you. That has been taken off. Now, the trunk infrastructure, if you ask me, what does that mean? I think you look into yourself and justify to yourself whether you have made the service housing plot habitable. Is there coverage? Is there lighting? Or is there everything which you would require for a service housing plot? So I think they've left it, you know, they've kind of left it open, left it ambiguous, and that's what the intent has been. Service housing plots also kind of give you another, I think there's another opportunity. Earlier, there was a minimum area, 25 acres, which was to be required for any service housing plot. Today, there is no minimum area for service housing plot. So I think this is an opening up in the most liberalized possible way, because today you can have a service housing plot of any area and you can just say that you just build a basic trunk infrastructure and you say, you know, I'm going to send it off. So there's FDI coming in without any area restrictions. Again, when you combine a service housing plot with a, you know, with a construction development project and it's a combination project, then again there is no minimum area requirement. So, you know, I don't know if that will lead to a lot of creative structuring or project where you would just have a lot of construction development projects and you would have one little service housing plot and you would say, oh, you know what, this is a completed, or if this is a combination project and therefore, you know, I don't need to comply with any minimum area requirement. I think another important issue which we all need to look at is the grandfathering provision. Is this, now obviously the press note or, you know, whenever it will come, is likely to be prospective, not retrospective. But the question is that the act of investment will be prospective, but will the act of exit be prospective or not, right? So if an investment has already happened and now that investor is exiting, will that exit be governed by the provisions of this fresh note or not? That is, I think, a question which I think we have to look at. Now, one view is obviously that, you know, when an investor invests, he invests on the premise of exit also. And therefore, you cannot have a policy which is retrospectively applicable. But again, I think that is a matter of ambiguity. And the way I see is that there will be a lot of debate on this. And the regulator might take a view that all the exits are a prospective act, and therefore, they should be subjected to this press release or the press note as and when it comes, even though your investment would have been compliant with the press note to 2005. So I think that's going to be an important one. I think another thing that it clarifies, and it's more of a clarification than a new thing, that sale of your shares from a non-resident to another non-resident would also be subjected to a notice. And I think there was a little bit of ambiguity around this, because the press note of 2005 said that it's the investment which is locked in for 3 years, and the view that many people took was that it's the investment and not the investor. So if the investor is changing hands, why should it apply? And I think even then we took a view which is, I think, you know, we always maintain that, that even though it says the investment is locked in for 3 years, the press note 2005 even went ahead to say that any exit prior to 3 years shall be with FIPB approval. So exit can be your secondary also. So if you are selling your shares from one NR to another NR, it is still an exit for the person who's selling, and therefore the lock-in or the restrictions of FDI policy would still apply on secondaries. The, you know, the other part which this is not clarified, and I thought I should kind of reiterate, is that if you are buying, if a non-resident is buying, right, from a non-resident, the period of 3 years or the lock-in period again starts for him from the day he purchases. It is not that investment, if 3 years are finished, you are done with that. So the lock-in resets when a new non-resident, you know, kind of purchases that. I think another aspect which I think we should, you know, we should kind of look at is affordable housing. That is Modi's vision, you know, to create a kind of social balance and encourage affordable housing. So today, what the press release says is, if that's the way I read it, is that if at an entity level you are incurring a 30% cost towards affordable housing, and that's defined over here to be less than 60 square meter kind of project or units, right? And it's defined here. You could also look at our hotline on this. If you are investing about 30% of your cost into affordable housing, then there is no minimum capitalization or minimum area conditionality that will become applicable on your other higher end luxury projects and all of that, you know. So nearly 30% cost allocation to affordable housing forgives you all your sins and everything, so you can do whatever in your remaining 70%, you know, and whatever you want to be. The idea initially was that the affordable housing and the luxury housing should be a part of the same project, which was the idea, so that, you know, there is social balance created, economically weaker section can mingle with the higher sections and all of that, but the language of this press release does not seem to suggest that. So I think the way I look at it is possibly you can have high-rise, high-luxury apartment or investment in Parel, and you could just have a 30% expense somewhere in Vasai or wherever, and, you know, kind of do away with this FDI conditionality. So I think this is largely, I think just one more point. I think the commencement of business, which was always very ambiguous, from which was, you know, the minimum capitalization of $5 million has to be brought in within 6 months of commencement of business, was always very ambiguous. That what does commencement of business mean, right? And the press note to work 2005 never defined it, but through a series of discussions with the DIPP and the FIPB, I think a view was taken at industry level that the commencement of business really meant when you sign the investment agreement or when you infuse the first tranche of foreign investment, because they wanted the foreign investment to come in within a certain period of time, right? So $5 million should have come in within 6 months of commencement of business, which really meant signing of first tranche of foreign investment or your investment agreement signing. That has been rationalized now, and commencement of business has been replaced with commencement of the project, which means the date when you get all your sanctions and the approvals. Now, again, that is pretty ambiguous on what that means. So, one view that you could possibly take and obviously the more conservative the better. But I think one of the views can be the day you get the IOD, within 6 months of that, you must bring in the minimum capitalization from a foreign investor perspective. I think those are largely the...
Super. Well said, Tushar, on the sort of changes. I was just with some client and he was joking with me that $14 billion of money was brought in from 2006 to 2013 on a two-page press release with that press note 2. Now I think there's a two-page clarification, which means there's a 100% change in what they had said earlier to what they have said now. Very quickly, moving to Nitin. Nitin, you're very close to LPs, helping a lot of people to fundraise. Do you think this affordable housing initiative is going to play in a certain way?
Sure.
What do you think is the impact there?
Sure. Thanks, Shobhit. Let me start by saying that mass housing projects, what you call affordable housing, has always been of interest to international investors and local developers. I think very interesting given the profile of the end user demand here. But the challenge we have faced all along is people have found implementing an affordable housing project to be very, very difficult. In the sense that without government support, which means sort of additional FSI support, they have found it to be very challenging to put together a project which is sufficiently viable. We've seen some projects which got set up sort of over the last 5-7 years, where people have got some support from some state government, and they have been able to put up, but the end result has not been very satisfactory from the developer's perspective. Another challenge is the definition of affordable housing varies from regulation to regulation. RBI for ECB purposes follows a different definition. Now we are seeing a sort of definition which is sort of saying that 50% of the FSI should be for units which is a 60 square meter. For our discussions with developers who are looking at this affordable housing platform, they are not really focusing their business plan based on these guidelines. They are putting together a plan which makes sense more from market perspective, which doesn't have to adhere to these kind of guidelines. There is an international demand for supporting these projects and need not necessarily abide by these regulations. At the same time, we've seen that we are involved with one of the platforms where they have tried to sort of use some of these guidelines to sort of put together a project which will partly meet the government criteria but at the same time meet market criteria as well. So I think market demand for this product, I think the experience has been very limited. People are still on a pilot basis on all these platforms. And I think to set up a sort of a mass scale, these kind of projects, will take some time. And another point is that most of these projects are typically set up outside the sort of a main city limit, which again I think sort of something which international investors are shying away from at this point of time. So I don't see a lot of foreign capital coming into these kind of platforms. Maybe a specific class of investors will support these platforms. But I think it's a beginning which is happening now.
You sort of represent on this room sort of developer side of the business. How excited are you guys with these sort of relaxations, both on the affordable side and the things that have been made on various definitions that Tushar has just explained? How excited are you guys, and are you guys going to start focusing a little bit more on affordable housing? Is that something that you guys are thinking about?
So, Shobhit, I'll take the question probably from the fund perspective, that we're managing, and we thought through very carefully the different strategies that we can work with on the development of housing. From our own perspective, we are very focused on mid-income housing, and there's some good reason for that, and those same reasons prevent us from participating in the affordable housing space. So I'll just touch on why we think the affordable housing space is still evolving, so to speak, is still emerging. One of the things is social infrastructure. So as the new clarification has come out, states, a lot of the affordable housing may go outside of the city. So it's a challenge to build social infrastructure. Second is transport. How do you get people back into their jobs, into the cities, where they want to work and earn their living? So that's the second problem. Sir, the biggest issue from my perspective is the cost. So we saw a period in India between 2009 and 2012, you can ask any developer this, where we saw costs run up in excess of 20% year on year. In affordable housing project, that's basically the end of the project. You're wiped out, because I'm sure you're not making 20% margin, and costs are going up 20% year on year. So those are the key challenges that come with affordable housing. That said, I think people now are gearing up to take on this model of housing, and they will start to do very well in the next 5-10 years because they track the model. They'll participate with government, they'll get into conversation, they'll get the right tax break. But it's going to be a cumbersome process, it's going to take a lot of efforts, and I think people who are getting into it are committed to this process. So on the other side, I think 10 years out, we'll see the experts. Yesterday, I think we are an expert in the mid-income housing segment. So you'll see experts developing in the affordable housing segment.
So you're saying that, while there's excitement about affordable housing, you still think there's restraint from the infrastructure development, both physical as well as social, to sort of get into this sector. Nitin, are you seeing the same thing from the investor perspective? Are you seeing renewed interest in affordable housing? What are the foreign investors telling us on
this? Right. As I said, I think the announcement has just been announced and the investors are looking at the fine print of these guidelines. But the fact of the matter is, as Karan was saying, there are very few operators in the country who can really implement this affordable housing strategy. So there are a handful of them, a couple of them who are already discussing. I think people have to demonstrate a couple of projects getting successfully delivered, which hasn't happened so far, for people to put a lot of capital behind these projects. So I think it will be a slow and steady sort of process. We will not see a lot of capital getting deployed to this strategy immediately.
You're saying that...
Okay, one more point. I think just to add to what Nitin is saying, I think people coming out would own the construction process. You know, that's how this is getting built out. Often you see contractors coming in, but I think developers going into affordable housing space do need to have a strong construction expertise to execute.
I think this kind of strategy requires integrated play, right from land acquisitions to approval, construction, marketing. I think the outsourcing model may not work here because you need to control costs at various stage of development process. So I think, as I said, there are only few operators in the country who can really implement this strategy. And the fact of the matter is, we have seen some numbers. This strategy doesn't require a lot of capital in short period of time. So where you can put up large number of projects with requiring not too much capital.
Yeah, so you're saying it's difficult to deploy as well in that sense, right? To put less money to work for a longer period of time.
For an affordable housing project to become less profitable, the land cost cannot exceed 10% of the sales price.
Yeah, and therefore you need more patient capital, little bit easy going. So that's, before we jump on to the core asset bandwagon, just one quick question on the return of equities. So far, we've seen that post-2009, most fund managers or Indian sort of fund managers were more keen to take lesser risk, right? Which meant either they were going towards debt structures and some jumped on to even lesser risk, which is core assets. We'll focus on that piece a little bit later. Do you think there will be a reversal where people will say, okay, fine, we're happy, given that most of the country has actually changed or reformed, especially in the approval process, that now people will be willing to take the approval risk.
Right.
4-5 years, there was paralysis on approvals,
right,
and now we've come up with a new sort of avatar. So is it really impacting? Is it going to be start?
Right.
Is private equity going to start looking at, the real equity?
Yeah. I think I would like to just say that, the real estate sector in India has evolved a long way. 2005, when the sector was opened up for foreign capital, I think it was fairly nascent. Prior to that, the developers were used to dealing with sort of capital which was not really institutional in character. So the capital, a lot of capital came in around that 3-4 year period, and I think the capital was not respected, so to say. And the money was deployed in areas where it should not have been deployed. There were a lot of learnings learned from all sides, from investors, from developers. I think the developers are also quite a natural loss right now. Investors also know which developers to back. And I think there's a lot of rationalism which has come in the sector. So we are seeing, as you rightly said, return of risk appetite from investor community. They are able to sort of pick up operators in the local market with whom they want to deploy capital, which can be deployed for long term. The limitation of deploying capital on MS basis or debt basis is that capital comes back to the investor in a relatively short period of time. And the investors who want to participate in Indian growth story, they want to deploy capital for 10 years and plus years, right? So they are looking for equity-backed strategies. Obviously, their market locations, the operators, and the kind of risk those projects would take are really clearly well defined. But we are seeing that character of capital coming back.
So they were saying there's sufficient learning now, and there has been enough sort of talent that's developed on the buy side. There's logic, there's sort of tail. The underwriting is now relatively easier.
Easier. I think all aspects have matured. And people are able to take informed calls on those parameters.
Roshit, this brings us to the next subject of completed assets. I think there's a lot of excitement with whatever little has been written in the press note too, and we want you to sort of guide us on what is the interpretation. Does it mean that, you know, today office assets and retail assets are allowed to be bought and sold freely, or does it have to comply with the original press note 3 style investing? So what is the new definition of core assets?
Yeah, so obviously enough ambiguity has been left in this press release as well to interpret it the way you want. And let's go back to what was the restriction, right? When we opened up to foreign investment in real estate, we opened up only to developmental capital. And anything which was not developmental capital tended to qualify as real estate business, which means investing in an immobile property with the idea of generating income therefore. Now that language is pretty ambiguous, because anything you do will generate income. But the idea was that we wanted to prohibit speculative land trading, right? So the idea was never that you come, you hold real estate, create a real estate bubble, and then you sell off that real estate, right? But that did not preclude investments in asset-heavy asset classes or real estate-heavy asset classes, so long as you're running the business, right? So let's say if you're buying a hotel, you're buying a warehouse, that was not considered real estate business, because then you're running the business, you're running the hotel, you're operating and maintaining the warehouse or your hospital, right? Even though a substantial chunk of that money, of that entity was really real estate. So I think that distinction has been very important. In that light, this press release says, in this paragraph, and I'll just read it out for the benefit of everyone, it says, it is clarified that 100% FDI under the automatic route is permitted in completed projects for operation and management or of township malls, shopping complexes, and business centers. Now, one view over here is that, you know, it only talks about operation and management. It says that you invest in completed projects, but only for operation and maintenance. So it does not presume the ownership of the completed asset. This is really only for O&M companies, right, that this clarification has been brought in. So if you're really a service company, which is only into operational maintenance, then you can get 100%, right? Now, the language is obviously not clear. But if you look at the intent, right, because it goes on to say it's promoted in completed projects. So even when we were having our discussions on REITs, because, you know, we were very closely involved in the drafting of the REIT regulations, and we had discussions with MOF and RBI, because REITs were largely intended to capture foreign capital. And REITs would be investing only in completed assets. So there was a discussion that, are you open to allow foreign investment indirectly through REITs into completed projects? And there, the view that came out of the discussion was that you need to see residential real estate and commercial real estate very differently.
when you buy residential real estate, you can set to be speculative in nature because you hold then real estate only as an investment product. But when you're buying a mall, or you're buying a hotel, or you're buying a large business center, you're not going to sell it off. If there's Mehta Masthani today, there's a leasing business, he's still going to sell off. He's providing many of the facilities. So in a shopping mall, you provide so much infrastructure. When a foreign investor invests, typically, he would invest with the idea of he's investing in the business, not just as an investment product. So you're running the business, right? And therefore, commercial real estate is not speculative in that nature. And therefore, you must separate commercial real estate from residential real estate. And I think the RBI agreed to that. And it gave an in-principle approval at that point in time, saying that it would be open to allow to exclude units of a REIT from real estate business. And that was on the premise that foreign investment would really come into commercial or more stabilized asset classes and not be speculative. In another matter, I am aware one of the funds, they approached the RBI for foreign investment into shopping mall, saying that the cloud and the RBI are okay with it. So I agree that the language is not very clear. But this is in question two, which is a real estate driven question. Otherwise, this is only a service company. And if you look at the entire premise, I think there is a need, and there was always an indication from the government to segregate commercial real estate from residential. So long as this is commercial real estate and you're investing in the business of the company, I think the intent was definitely to allow this, but the language is not clear. So I think if anyone is choosing to invest in completed real estate projects, I think best would be to get another set of clarification from the government, because that's how this industry works. You know, the press will say something, yet you keep on getting clarifications. Because even if you get a legal opinion from me or anyone, that will not hold up against ability action fee. So, but I think if you look at the larger scheme and also look at the press note which allowed hotels, investment in hotels and all, use similar language, right? So I think if you look at the intent and then you read this press note, I think you would see an inclination to open up completed assets. And if you see, the largest intent is because foreign investors are not interested in developmental assets today. They are looking at core assets, and that's the area which was always intended to be opened up, right? So I think that's the intent. The language is not very clear, but I think we'll probably need to get more clarifications. But I think the intent was definitely to open up.
Thank you. Also, just to add, one of the reasons why a view could be taken that this has been opened up is because a lot of foreign investors have invested in shopping malls and
office buildings
at a construction development stage. Now all those buildings have been constructed, and these are very large buildings where you can't find domestic investors. So the only buyer of these assets can be a foreign investor. Now if for those foreign investors, completed assets is not opened up for foreign investment, these guys will never be able to exit. So that is also, a lot of private equity investors have made representations to the government that we are stuck with these assets, we need exit. So you need to open up because every country has to mature. It starts with construction development, but what after the construction development has happened? You need to provide for foreign investment in completed assets. So I think intent seems to be to open up completed assets, but at the same time, the devil lies in details and the language, and the regulators go by the language of the press note. So that's where I think, as Richard rightly mentioned, if something needs to be done, clarification from a regulator would be better before that action is taken.
Just when you move on this subject, Mangeshil, quickly, if we were to assume that ready assets are now allowed to be traded, both in terms of offices or business centers and shopping malls, will the FBI regulation on size apply to them? Does it need to be a 50,000 square meters or a 20,000 square meters at the minimum, or any size is open? Because there's no mention of the size on this. So what is your view on this?
So that is another ambiguity. Yeah. Because unlike hotels, etc., which says that, I think I would like to see this as more of a form of clarification. Because this is saying for operation and maintenance, right? For hotels and all, it talks when it's in construction development stage. This is allowed when this is a clarification, even when it is completed. And it is only when you're operating and maintaining. If you're just constructing it and selling it, that's not, that will still go under the press note 2005 where the sectoral condition anti-subsistra will apply because that will become a pure construction development. But if the project is completed and then you are selling it, then I think the way that when you look at it is completely independent asset class. Like today, hotels does not find a mention in the FDI policy at all, or a warehouse doesn't find a mention in the FDI policy at all, and because it doesn't find a mention, it goes under the 100% automatic route. Why? Because it is seen as a completely different asset class. So I think the way I would like to look at this is that if it's completed and you are operating and maintaining it, it's a completely different asset class, and therefore there is no requirement of any 20,000 square meter requirement.
Thanks for that clarification. You know, quickly moving on to fundraising and you know their preferences. There's been a considerable traction on the fundraising on Indian side as well. As far as we are informed, about $3 billion is in various stages of being raised or raised already. People like Milestone, Kotak, India REIT, Godrej have raised. However, we are finding that the relationship between a normal GP LP, if you want to call it, or the LP with the developer is changing. Right? We're getting stickier capital because these are sovereigns that are coming in, pension funds that are coming in. So I suppose the qualities of LPs that were there in 2006 versus what is happening now itself has changed. And therefore they're driving differences between what was the classic 220 set up in a commingled fund to versus what is now. I think that it will be nice if you can sort of throw in some light, and especially the fact that you've also helped your neighbor Godrej on this and they're doing something new. How do you see and what are the different relationships? What are the new terms? And where is it going to go on a long-term basis? So is the next 2 years going to be similar to what you've been doing now?
Right. If you look at, you know, pre-global financial crisis, right, which is 2008, most of the money which all these pension funds, sovereign funds were investing were through the fund round, that is through the MP, traditional MPGP structure. The reason being that at that point of time, they had very limited experience of going out of their home market and investing in international markets, and they were relying on local managers to help them select investment partners in the local market. But during the financial crisis period and years after that, I think some of the large pension funds and sovereign funds realized the need to have greater control on their investment and also the fact that they wanted to boost their own return from the investment. They felt that really some of the managers are not really adding value which they were looking from them. So what we have seen is not only India or emerging markets, but elsewhere as well, all these sovereign fund, pension funds particularly, are reaching out to the operators or identified managers in respective markets and are trying to do either joint ventures, separate accounts, or clubs. There, I would put all these three terms like joint ventures, clubs, and separate accounts in one category, which gives them the kind of aspects they are looking at, which is control and sort of a greater return from their investment portfolio. The fact of the matter is that the fund of funds, which also used to be a very important provider of capital, they have diminished over the period, and globally, very few fund of funds are getting raised at this point of time. So essentially, all the funding which is coming, either to managers or to operators, is coming from pension funds and sovereign funds directly. And those guys increasingly are becoming active to all these JVs or clubs or separate accounts. So we've seen regions like Canada, regions like Europe becoming more active in these structures, whereas US market still believes in LP, traditional LPGP structure. So we're seeing LPs from that market continue to rely on asset consultants to help them source managers to deploy capital. So going forward, I see that I think increasingly sort of these clubs and JVs will become more popular. Larger amount of capital is going to be deployed through those structures. I'm not saying that the traditional LPGP structure will die. I think it will coexist. But I think the importance of that sort of structure to deploy significant LP capital will come down over the period. And it will be used only in very strict sort of cases where there are not too many operators in the market, and you need to aggregate various operators, and that's where the LP will rely on the concerned GP to sort of aggregate various operators for a particular strategy they want to, they want to deploy their capital.
I'm going to ask you, you've done JV with APG, how has that experience been, and what has it taught you?
I'll talk about it in a second. I just want to see if I can just reverse the question to you and Nitin. I want to ask you guys is how do you think the relationship between commingled funds and joint venture club type deals exists? Do they complement each other, or do you think if it's going towards co-investment type vehicles, then commingled suffer?
I think the views may be different, but a quick view on our side is that I think the kind of what we're seeing in the market is that today, you know, sovereigns as well as pensions are willing to commit very large checks.
Right.
And given that they have the ability to write out large checks, they don't want to be in the commingle with $5 and $15 million checks because they've got long-term strategy, they've got patient capital. Right? So the kind of money that sort of clients that used to mingle earlier is not there. Second, all of these today have experience. India is no more in 2005 stage. There are people who put sufficient amount of money. So there's LP experience, there's GP experience. There's been developers who deployed that money. They know how to now, what are the challenges that they faced. I'm saying all of it did not really go down. So this is $14 billion worth of experience is there in this country now. So our sense is that it is driven to more patient capital. You rather have one or two investors and grow with them. Then to say I will do a $20 million deal on a project basis with a commingled fund, you know, I think from a occupier, from a guy who's receiving that money, I think he's happier doing what you are saying. And you know, Godrej is a good example. I'm sure there are all options available to you, but you chose to go with one large check to say, look, I have this guy, equal partners, we'll do things together. There's no problem with transparency. We are very happy to be transparent. But it's driving the level of MIS, the transparency, the partnership to a different level. Nitin, I don't know what your experience.
So I'd say that I think the LPs are looking at alignment of interest and also sort of the value add feature. So I think increasingly the demands on value add from a manager, right, from traditional GP, I think are increasing. So I think the managers really do as to why they should be seeking or getting this capital to deploy in terms of the biggest operator. And alignment of interest is also something which I think GPs are sometimes struggling to demonstrate. If a GP is able to demonstrate these two features, alignment of interest and value add, I think they still get them for that.
And I suppose the most important thing is his returns. His past track record, if he can demonstrate that he's made money,
yes.
I'm sure there's more money that he can also raise. Right? But there's very little of that currently in India. And
he's gone into learning.
So, yeah. So, I guess, you know, bit of both. But, yeah, question back to you.
Yep.
That you've led this change. You are amongst the first guys to do a JV. How's that experience been? And what were some of the different sort of broad level terms, not specific, but in terms of relationship, what are the principal drivers to that relationship?
Right. I was actually trying to get away from the question, but it came back to it. So, more seriously, and maybe we can take Nitin's comments as well. He was involved with that when we were trying to come up with this program. I think, from my perspective, the program has been successful, which is good, which allows us to go get more capital. But also what it does is it allows the sector overall to benefit, because I think the real measure of the real estate sector doing well in India means equity capital is going to come back, because we can't keep living off debt capital, and we need to get equity to build out sort of the real estate sector. So that's our view. Two things need to happen. One is very clearly the LP needs to step up, right? They need to take more responsibility, more accountability. They need to be available. So they need to respond fast because they are now involved in the decision-making process of the investment. The investment, you know, were to go bad in a way, they're not the only people to blame. They're fully informed, and they're taking an informed call as well. So they're, you know, part one of that decision. So it requires a more involved and a stepped up LP. On the GP side, I think a lot of work needs to be done if we are all going to make the sector better. Clearly, like Nitin was alluding to earlier, transparency, governance, accountability, all of those things are very, very important. And, of course, alignment of interests. If that can be demonstrated, then I think there's a bright future for co-investment slash club team type structures.
On the LPGP structure, I think it's increasingly going to get difficult for the GPs, because what the LPs have been doing, and this is not common to India, it is common in all the countries, they start with investing in various funds, so they with minimal rights, so GP pretty much controls everything. The next phase is the managed account, where you know, the GP is only managing the funds of the investor, but the LP has many more rights as compared to what it had as an LP. The next stage is the LPs themselves start investing in India, like Canadian Pension Fund is setting up an office in India. Why should I pay 2% management fee to GP? Why should I rely on somebody else's capability of in sourcing deals and exiting? So I think that phase of being an LP to being an LP in a managed account to directly being an investor in India is something which is a natural progression for any LP. And that's where it's going to get more and more difficult for GPs to get investment from, at least from the sovereign and the pension funds in long run.
Right. I think that's what I was saying. I was alluding to this value add feature. I think the demands on value add, I think the capabilities of GP are increasing a lot because they are no longer in that 10-year-old period where they didn't know the market, they didn't know the operator. Over the last 10 years, they invested in the PM. They know sort of who are the guys to back, and they are able to reach out to those guys directly. So hence, the role of a GP is sort of diminishing over the period.
Yeah. Also, you know, Nitin, will you comment on what just on the fact that you know India is sort of now maturing, and you can differentiate on sort of strengths of a particular operator. So, for example, if I was going to partner Godrej, I definitely know they're probably the best in the mid-market segment, right? Whereas somebody else may be very focused on core assets. So really, I would think that the GPs or the LPs now know where to play on whose strength. So different strategies are coming up, and, you know, they're going up to say, it's not optimistic anymore. Figure out what your strategy is, and I'm going to back you on one strategy. And not, you know, you're not the generalist anymore.
Yeah.
I think that's also playing in a
very important role. I think so, like LPs are very clear about which strategies to play in the market, and they are selecting operators accordingly or their partners accordingly. And it might happen because they don't want to have too many partnerships also in a particular country. It might happen they use same operator for executing different strategies. But sort of they are going to have very few partnerships because at the end of the day they are small teams. They cannot have a sort of large number of partnerships in any particular market.
Absolutely. You know, Ruchil brings us back to what are the structures for fundraising, right? There's no conversation that's complete without structures. Debt, mezzanine, equity, are there traditions? And I asked this question earlier to Nitin, traditional equity structures back. What are you seeing? What are your clients telling you?
Yeah, so I think real estate has come to the full cycle. Start off with equity, preferred equity, quasi-debt, structured debt, pure debt. And I think that market has kind of reached a level, right? And I'm definitely seeing a resurgence of traditional equity structures. In the couple of deals that we are doing, we have seen a resurgence of the distribution waterfalls. Again, the 30% IRR plus and waterfall is again back. And I don't understand where is that money going to come from. But I'm again seeing a resurgence of those kind of, you know, structures with large offshore funds. So I think definitely, because, you know, the domestic debt market is being populated by a lot of the mushrooming NBFCs, especially real estate focused. So I think the offshore guys who are looking for deployment of larger monies and in larger developers, they don't have much choice. The larger developers have got, you know, the CMBN is also kind of, you know, looped and everything. So I think, and LRDs and everything. So I think the issue is that where do you invest and how do you deploy? So I think there I'm seeing resurgence among the large developers and the large funds of, you know, to go back to the traditional equity structures and the money being used largely for land acquisitions and, you know, kind of new projects. But I think in terms of structure, maybe Nishil, you want to just talk about, you know, the jurisdictions, etc., how are we raising money and everything.
Well, quickly touch upon that. As far as the jurisdictions are concerned, for both equity and debt, equity, again, Mauritius still remains the preferred jurisdiction. Subject to the CAR provisions coming in, Singapore and Netherlands also have been looked at by a lot of GPs who are setting up funds. But if debt is part of the investment strategy, then clearly the choice is between Singapore and Netherlands, which the investors have been making. Coupled with the fact that how much substance you are able to establish in these jurisdictions. A lot of times the investors may not have substance in Singapore, but they have substance in Netherlands. Then they have been going ahead and setting up funds in Netherlands. Netherlands also has a very good is a very good fund jurisdiction and has an excellent tax treaty and bilateral investment treaty with India. So Netherlands has also we have been setting up a lot of funds in Netherlands in addition to setting up funds in Singapore. So broadly, if debt is part of the strategy, Singapore and Netherlands, if it's only equity strategy, then we have been seeing Mauritius, Singapore and Netherlands all three being used for investing into India.
And what about NCD structures versus NBFCs and domestic AIFs? Where do you see...
I think the, you know, the air of apprehension of the NCD structures is kind of clear. You know, we pioneered the first ever NCD structure in real estate, and there was so much you can cry about it, that is it foreign debt and this and that. And I think since then, I don't know how many have happened. And I think we have the blessing of the SEBI, you know, the RBI and all the regulators, you know, that this structure is blessed, right? Security enforcement is legit. And through a debenture trustee, you can create security interest and all of that. So, and I think I keep saying this, that, you know, when people go out in offshore conferences, they say, you know, no one has made money in India. And the sentiment of no one has made money in India is much louder than the few people who try and say, oh, you know, I made some money. Because people who don't make money always make more noise. You know, and if you see these NTD structures that we've done, about 20% IRR kind of structures, large, mostly they were pure debt structures, but the initial ones that we did were really equity structures on the backing of the NTD platform, you know, payable enabled gather structures, industry waterfalls and all.
Those redemptions are happening. So there are many players who have received this 20% IRR and all, but unfortunately there's no one tracking that and showing that. Show that even your report only talks about secondary, but no one is tracking the NTD redemptions, which is actually giving out cash and you know, and this you know, really happening. So I think that and there are today many funds which are raised only on the premise of the NTD structure. Of course, the RDR fund is a pure NTD based fund. There are so many funds which are, you know, even the Morgan Stanley Hyper Property is a pure NTD based fund. So there's obviously a great demand for the NTD structure and it's selling. Now you come to the debate of what works better, NTD is an offshore lending model or the NBFC is an onshore lending model. And there have been, you know, we worked on several of these NBFCs, the GIC KKR one, you know, the GN Financials, NBFC Liquor Fund. I think there's a mushrooming of real estate focused NBFCs, and I think where they match up and where you could probably say that yes, NBFCs might be a better way of doing most lending in India. I think obviously one is that NBFCs can directly take security interest, as against in NTD structure where you lend out security trust. In the NTD structure, you have a $51 billion cap. You never know when it comes down or, you know, at what stage how it works, you know. So there's a little bit of apprehension on that. There is, the NTD structure can only work with FPI registration, right? So you will have to see whether you're qualified to get an FPI registration. Or obviously, today it is very liberalized, but it's still certain conditionalities which you need to meet. And once you do a listed NTD, the company becomes listed under Indian Companies Act under certain compliances, the NBFC doesn't ensure. So with NTD, you can only do debentures. With NBFC, you have freedom to do pure loans or whatever you want to do. So honestly speaking, there is not much of a difference. Obviously, with an NBFC, there is a challenge in terms of the prudential loss, etc., that kick in
which are earlier 100 crores, now 500 crores and above. So the issue is that, you know, you cannot lend more than 15% to one company or 25% to a group, which is not the case with NTDs. There's complete freedom.
So I think it's a
pros and cons of each.
Just on the point on equity versus debt, we have been hearing that a lot of foreign investors have lost money on equity investments in India. On the other hand, both Nitin and Richard both mentioned that pension funds and sovereign funds, they usually prefer to get money, you know, after some time, because if they're getting their money back in 1, 2 years or 3 years time, then it's not good because they have to then redeploy. So there's a classic case where if you don't get money, you have a problem. If you get money fast, you also have a problem. So depending on the type of investor, you know, you have to figure out which instrument works better for you and for the investors on what is the IRR you have promised to your investor. But just on the domestic fundraising, there's always this question on whether the pooling vehicle should be an NBFC or a domestic alternative investment fund, AIF. And there again, there are differences between the two models. Like for example, the NBFC model, you are taxed at 30% on whatever interest income you receive. Similarly, under the AIF model, also you are taxed at the same rate. But the difference is under the AIF, which will be set up as Category 2 AIF or debt fund, there the ability to leverage is very limited. You can only leverage for temporary requirement for 30-day period as compared to NBFC where, you know, you can pretty much leverage and reduce your overall tax cost. So from that perspective, NBFC works better. Second is in NBFC, there is no issue on pass-through. NBFC is investing and it is getting income and it is paying tax. As compared to that, the investors are putting in money in an AIF where currently there are different judgments which keep on coming from different tribunals on the taxability of income of an AIF. So to that extent, there is some uncertainty which is attached to the taxability of income by an AIF. Another pro for NBFC is typically if you want a scalable model for an NBFC for to lend money, then NBFC is a better model as compared to an AIF, which is typically a limited life model where, you know, you have to wind up the fund within a certain period of time. Again, as far as the regulations are concerned, NBFCs are heavily regulated by Reserve Bank of India as compared to AIF, which is regulated by SEBI. So to that extent, you know, you have a lesser stringent regulator as compared to what NBFCs have in the form of RBI. Another couple of other points are if you're looking at foreign investment in an NBFC, then if the NBFC is a loan NBFC, then you don't have to approach FIPB because this is something which is under automatic route. As compared to that, if you are getting money from offshore LPs also and you are looking at a unified structure where you are pooling both domestic LPs and offshore LPs in India, in that situation, you will need an FIPB approval for foreign investment to come in Category 2 debt AIF.
I think just one point, you know, that foreign investment approval into an AIF used to be very restricted earlier.
Yeah.
That approval typically never came. But now it's starting to come for Category 2 real estate funds. So I think that's a very welcome change. So you might just look at some of these Category 2 AIFs.
Yeah. Also, one welcome change which has recently been made is in the NBFC regulation. The limit of 100 crore for systemically important non-deposit taking NBFC has been raised to 500 crore. So typically, if you are just raising funds from domestic LPs, 400 to 500 crore is a decent size. And if you manage to fit in within the less than 500 crore category, you can pretty much run an NBFC without any substantial requirement or compliance with prudential norms and other requirements. So that's also something which now will be, this was one of the key reasons why AIF was also preferred as compared to NBFC, but now with this limit being increased from 100 to 500 crore, this is something which can be.
Yeah. Before we wrap up the session, a lot has been said on regulations, on LP interest, policy change. And before I wrap up, we'll just quickly open the session for a Q&A. I don't know if there's somebody online who will do it.
Yeah. I think one point that could be covered in our invite and some people might be looking forward to it is the treatment of redemption premium on your non-convertible debentures. And that has been a controversial topic. And typically, we always and the industry standard has always been. So for the issuer or the payee company, the treatment is very clear that it will be deductible. For the recipient, view could be that it's capital gains or interest. And the industry standard has generally been to regard this coupon or interest and therefore withhold, but technically they can still be positioned to say that it can be deductible for the Indian company and yet be a capital gain for the recipient. It will obviously depend on the facts and circumstances of each matter. Where this will largely work is for benefiters in context of payable and able kind of bonds or the zero coupon entire equity upside being captured as redemption premium. So I think we are running short on time, but you know we can kind of discuss that later. But just wanted to kind of touch on this.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, so I think
we can have questions from the audience.
I think we can have questions from the people on the call first.
Yeah. Certainly, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on your touchtone telephone. Participants are requested to only use handsets while asking a question. Anyone who has a question at this time, please press star and one on your touchtone telephone. The first question is from the line of Abhishek Gupta from Fidji. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Hello. Hi, Abhishek.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah, okay. I just want to clarify, we are on a mobile speaker. Are you saying that the minimum area where FDI is allowed is 50 million square feet, right? 50,000 square feet.
It's 50,000 square meters.
It was originally 50,000 square meters.
So I mean, maane ki 5 lakh, 5 lakh, 5 lakh square.
Yeah, 5 lakh 40,000.
Okay. So effectively, and that's for any city in the country, right? Doesn't matter.
Yes, that's correct. Now it has been reduced to 20,000 square meter, which is approx 2 lakh square feet.
Yeah, so that's very clear. Now FDI includes both debt and equity investment, right? Or just equity?
So FDI would only include equity and instruments compulsorily convertible into equity.
If I'm looking at foreign debt, what is the kind of regulation for that? Number one, that's my question. Number two, I'm from the education industry where we might end up not owning a property which is, 5 million square feet at one time, but it will be a combination of, is it possible to structure in such a way that my SPV owns properties which are totally 5 million square feet in area and then do an FDI, both either debt / equity?
So the foreign debt can either be routed through compulsorily convertible debentures, but there will be a challenge in terms of repatriation of principal, or it can come in through the listed NCD route, which we call also as the under the FDI regime or the foreign portfolio investment regime. And there is no area restriction at all. So, we'll have to look at it. I think that's a little specific question. We can, we can take it offline. Education institution obviously also have, exemptions under the FDI policy, but not when you're having a PropCo, PropCo kind of a structure. Yeah. So, we'll have to look at all of that in a little more detail. You could mail us and we can kind of get back to you.
What is the email ID?
You could mail it to
NDA Admission.
You could mail it to NDAAdmissionDesai.com.
Okay, NDAAdmissionDesai. Okay. I'm a senior vice president and head of admission strategy with Fidji, which is an education institute. We are a leading education institute. So I hope this is the right person, Admission Desai Associate.
Yeah, that's right.
And what about the first question about the second? Whether we can structure it in a way where 5-6 copies are.
Can we just discuss a specific data?
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of questions and people sitting here. So we can just take it off.
No specific. I mean, this is a very generalistic question. You will have a lot of people who might not be able to, you might be looking at acquiring real estate and funding that real estate, and they won't have that minimum, $5 million per property. So how do we structure that?
So that's what I said. We can discuss that. There are a lot of people. So there you can do a
FPI regime kind of a structure, but let's discuss that offline because there are a lot of people in the queue right now. All right. Can we move on to the next question, please?
Sure. The next question is from the line of Francis Hokip from Pragna Advisors Limited. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Firstly, thanks for the meaningful and useful discussion. I just have two queries. First is, Ruchir, you briefly touched about transferring one stake from a non-resident to another non-resident.
Yeah.
Earlier, the understanding was if the lock-in is over, we can transfer the stake from one non-resident to another without going through the FPIPB approval.
After lock-in, you can do it, but the lock-in will start afresh for the new...
Right, for the new investor. But under the current press release, it says the transfer of stake by one non-resident to another non-resident before completion of the project. So now if I want to transfer one stake in one project to another non-resident investor, can I do it after the login period? Can I still do it? Or I have to wait for the completion of the project?
No, you can
do that. I think it's more of a language issue, but the intent is that as long as you have completed 3 years from the date of your final investment, even if the project has not been completed, you can transfer from NR to NR without FIPB.
So you add the words whichever is earlier after it, even
though it's not. Whichever is earlier, okay. The second question is on, right, thanks a lot for that. The second question is on the affordable housing. There are two clauses regarding the affordable housing. One which says if you have 30% of your cost on affordable housing project, you don't have to comply with the minimum cap and the minimum area. And the second which defines affordable housing as, you know, if you spend 60%, if you construct 60% of your FSI as, you know, this much square foot and all that.
Correct.
So what we are trying to do is, how do you marry the two clauses? Is it the 30% applicable at the entity level, or is it applicable on the project level?
It's applicable on the entity level if we read it.
So let's say I have a project or entity in which I spend 30% of my cost on developing a project, an affordable housing project, in which I have 60% of the FSI in affordable housing. Then in all the other projects under the same entity, I can do any type of development.
So long as the total cost is 30% or more.
Right. The total cost of 30% is on those affordable housing projects.
Yeah, that's the way it reads.
That's the way it should read. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
So it can be those two projects. It doesn't have to be one single project or two parcels, two contiguous land projects.
That's what I mentioned when I spoke.
Right.
It should not be
located.
It has to be entirely in area.
Right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The next question is from the line of Kareem Merchant from GID. Please go ahead.
Gentlemen, thanks for a very informative panel again. My first question builds on the previous question on non-resident transfer. If the transfer is happening not at the blocker level, so hypothetically if there's a structure that involves a U.S. entity owning a Cyprus or Mauritian entity that owns the Indian SPV, and the transfer occurs at the U.S. level and not at the actual owner of the Indian entity, does that still qualify as...
This policy only applies with respect to transfer of Indian company shares. This doesn't apply to indirect transfers.
So it can, the U.S. level won't apply.
Yeah,
that's correct. Only thing you will have to still take care of the indirect transfer tax issue, but that's more of a tax issue, not an exchange control issue.
Correct, that's fine. And my second question was on NCDs. Historically, and this is my limited understanding of the NCD security, a lot of funds had chosen the NCD route primarily as a structuring nuance because they couldn't invest in ready assets or nearly completed assets. And the objective was to really get equity-like exposure. Now with the changes to the policy, do you think NCDs would still remain a preferred secured for having a capped return, etc., for those looking for equity-like exposure? Is it much easier now to just take direct equity exposure?
No, sir, Kareem, I think that NCD route is a completely different route, which is under foreign portfolio investment route. That is different from the foreign direct investment route under which this press release or press note will be issued. So nothing under this press release impacts the NCD investment under the foreign portfolio investor route. Also, nothing in this press release is going to make the FDI investment much better than the FPI investment. Because you said that the rotation of 3 years.
I understand that one is FDI, one is FPI. I think my question, and I don't want to take too much time, but I think my question was more that people chose the FPI route with certain limitations in the FDI policy. And
but
so,
Karim, just to answer the question quickly, I think if you honestly look at it, FPI would still be the preferred route for people who are earlier doing. I don't think this policy gives you so much comfort that it can trump over the FPI route. There's still 20,000 square meters. If you want to invest in prime Bombay, I don't know.
Lock-in requirements are there.
So I think FPI will still prevail when you're eligible, and you can do that. There's a trend that we've been seeing. Equity structures on the debt platform is what kind of.
And also sometimes it works for investing company as well, because you're able to claim interest expense from the investing company.
It's efficient for both the sides.
Okay, thanks, guys.
All right.
Thank
next
you.
Question.
So
next
there are no
question.
More questions in the queue.
All right.
Okay. So maybe we can
thank you so much.
We can quickly have questions.
Yeah,
maybe another question from the audience.
Is there any questions in the audience? Okay. That was pretty silent too. Then I have probably...
No, he has a question. Yeah.
My name is Amit Dev. I am an advisor on international trade abroad. And this IIT and this two-page clarification, I mean, the new clarification, how much of the haziness of the earlier two pages covered under this and how much remains in haze? Because I was in a presidential tour of Scandinavia some days back, claimed to be world's biggest pension fund of Norway. So they are staying away because of the haziness. They are saying if it is said, this is all and nothing beyond, as one byline, we understand this. But when nothing beyond is not written, everything beyond may happen. And as an ethical country and ethical fund, being one of the biggest, we cannot put our neck across to such an uncertain situation. So what is your comment towards that?
I was saying that there is nothing like an ideal draft. No matter what comes in, you would always have clarification questions around it, and I don't think there can be a perfect draft of anything. But I think this kind of addresses a lot of queries. Some ambiguities remain, which I mentioned, and they will possibly remain. But I think it's a good draft and pretty prospective. Certain aspects like commencement of business, etc., way too ambiguity. The 50% conditionality has been clarified over here in a very objective way. So I think it's a lot better than fresh notes.
I'll give the details to Nishit Bhai. Because they need some clarification, and then probably such a giant can move into India, and that will make it great.
Yeah, we'll that's
not an issue for it from all sides. But then not only them to see the road.
Is the fog so bad that you cannot just drive? Otherwise, fog is a very nice thing as well. Feel good, and but you have fog lights with lawyers and other colleagues here will be happy to provide.
One of the important things which at least SEBI has started, and which is something which all other regulators need to learn, is you see the latest insider trading regulation draft. Under each regulation, they have mentioned the intent of that regulation and sub-regulation. So they want to ensure that there is no way two persons can interpret this regulation differently. So I think somewhere we are moving towards that. And I think it's the right way to draft any regulation where you also take public comments. You put the draft for public comment for 30 days, you get comments from the public, and then you finalize the draft. I think that's something which Reserve Bank of India can also move towards that concept where at least, they get comments from the public, and like some of these things could be clearly avoided before they go into the actual press note. On the completed assets, we saw how many ambiguities are there under this. So I think it's more of a question of how do we draft any legislation rather than within the legislation what ambiguities are there. Thank you.
Any more questions?
So we have three questions in the queue from the audio conference.
Can we take them later, I think?
I think you can
actually
take, I think, one of those questions, and we can take one, and the rest we can address.
Yeah, we can take one more question, please.
Sure, sir. It's from the line of Vandana Sagar from PwC. Please go ahead. Vandana, your line is unmuted. Please go ahead. So there's no response. We'll take the next question from the line of Namrata Malu from MyRit. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hi. Hi. So I was hearing about, I'm sorry, I joined in the middle of the conversation, so I probably must have missed it. So under the FPI route, I understand that there are not a lot of rules or regulations and norms, so it's a lot easier to work through. Are there any specific people in India who are sourcing funds for FPI? Are there funds who are doing that route?
So there are a number of platforms which have been set up in the recent past who are using the FPI route for making investments into real estate. Kotak being one where about $400 million have been committed by RDI and QIA. TPBID, Piramal platform, $500 million, also using FPI route to make investment. And there are other sectors also like the APG Piramal platform infrastructure, which is also using FPI route to make debt investment in the infrastructure. So there are some guys who are using that route as well. So I think this is a quite popular way of putting money into real estate in India at this point of time.
But would these funds be typically looking at something which is like a bigger amount in terms of transactions? So they would not be looking at a size which is 5 million or whatever. They would typically be looking at something which is at least 25, 50 million plus kind of transaction size, right?
We have seen transaction size ranging from $10 million to $50 million and upward.
Okay.
$5 million has happened or not, I'm not sure, but we have seen $10 million size
transactions. I think it should at least be 10 to 20.
That would be the process efficient.
Yeah. But otherwise, I think for $5 million transaction, at least the question of SBI has become very simple. So if you can find a foreign investor who is willing to fund $5 million, it shouldn't be too difficult to get an SBI registration for that foreign investor.
Okay. So typically, it would be like a month kind of a process for doing an FPI registration if you find an individual investor outside?
Yeah. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So just
one thing. If anyone has questions on the call, you could mail us on nda@nishithdesai.com. Malika, you could please just announce that and we could then kind of take questions from the audience here.
Sure.
Yeah, all right. With that, I'd like to thank the panelists for sharing their thoughts on the new FDI policy, and Nitin and Karan for your sort of sharing your experience on fundraising and deployment. Thank you all of you for being here.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And all the people on the call for taking out your time to listen to us. Thank you once again.
Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nishith Desai Associates, that concludes this conference call. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.